Fancast. I'm your host, Ivy Reisner, and this is episode 90, a review of Right Starts. I've been reading Right Starts, Prompts, Quotes, and Exercises to Jumpstart Your Creativity by Hal Zina Bennett, kind of obsessively. I'm really enjoying this book. It comes out February 16th, 2010. I got a reviewer's copy. It's basically a book of exercises to sort of get the creative juices flowing, and it works something like this. Did you ever have a situation where you started reading a book and then you wanted to take a part of the story off on a completely different tangent? Okay, a wild tangent. To talk about wild tangents. Every time I read The Magician's Nephew by C.S. Lewis, I want to change it. And the sticky point for me is that Diggory wants this magic fruit to save his sick mother's life. Aslan tells him no, and then Aslan tells him yes, and the whole situation as to why he tells him no and why Diggory obeys that is because of some undisclosed dire consequences that will befall him if he tells it. As an aside to an aside, I want to know what the trick is to get so many readers to buy into undisclosed dire consequences. But the consequences aren't so much dire because there's something about the fruit or the magic or anything like that. It's just about obeying Aslan. So when Diggory does the huge, dangerous quest for Aslan, Aslan just changes his mind. Diggory doesn't change in the story, and he's not really a driving force for this element, this major element of the story, even though he is the protagonist. He's basically an okay character from the outset, and so I keep wanting to change the stakes. Largely, I don't want undisclosed dire consequences. Universally, trying to save the life of an innocent person is termed good. Trying to keep someone from saving the life of an innocent person is termed evil, except in this story. I also want to know the trick of presenting a hero who's trying to stop someone from saving their innocent mother's life and still have them come off as a hero. I have no idea how this works. But the way I keep wanting to change it is something like, okay, maybe Diggory wants a healing power. Sure, of course, he'll use it for a sick mother, but Aslan knows he's just not ready. And over the course of the story, he sees sick and injured people, and slowly, bit by bit, he realizes he wants to heal more than just his mom. In fact, he wants to understand the healing so he can generalize it for use all over the world. He wants to become this great healer and help a lot of people. When he steps away from the greedy, self-centered desire to a more noble goal, then he grows and he proves himself worthy of the apple and the power. Center it on Diggory's growth. Alternatively, to move the allegory closer, the fruit gives someone perfect knowledge of how the human body works and all the energies and magics related to it to heal or to harm. In this variation, Diggory might have a vengeful streak, and Aslan might fear he might use this to do mild but inappropriate harm to others. When he learns mercy and grows in kindness and in tolerance, he proves himself worthy, and then he gains the fruit. But mostly, I want to change it to make more of a sense of what the consequences are. So not just a bad thing will happen, but he's likely to not use it appropriately. He's likely to abuse it. He's likely to any sort of bad thing central to the character. And I want it to be more integral to the protagonist, because the events of the story should be driven by the protagonist. If the character gets into a bad situation, it should be at least in part because of the choices he makes, directly or tangentially. They don't need to be wrong choices. A character could enter a dangerous situation out of heroism or misunderstanding or conflicting goals, but the character shouldn't just be dumped meaninglessly into the situation. The problem shouldn't just come out of nowhere. This great sacrifice of Diggory's mother's life should not just be like, oh, by the way, we just felt like, you know, saying you can't save her. It should be central to the choices he has made throughout the story. And the consequences should be spelled out in any story. Pride and Prejudice. If Mrs. Bennet can't marry off at least one of her daughters well, then when Mr. Bennet dies and the estate of Longbourn goes to Mr. Collins, as it is entailed to do, then she and her daughters will be homeless. Very simple consequences, very obvious consequences. They're not mysterious. We totally understand them. We totally get the story. And look at go as far as House of Mirth. Lily Bart must marry well or face destitution. it works for that, and it works all the way straight on down the line to a Batman comic. Batman must stop the Joker before he can kill a bunch of innocent people in Gotham. It's so integral to story, what the consequences are, that spelling them out is so integral to storytelling that it is always in the very first sentence of a query letter. So I keep wanting to edit this, and I do that with a lot of stories. I read them and I think, oh wow, this little element is so cool. I want to just take it off and go somewhere completely different with it, or I like this, but I just want to change that part, or I like this and I just want to completely rewrite the ending, or I'll get that like a chapter in or a few chapters in and say, oh, I want the story to go this way, and just start making it up in my head as I go. And that's how Write Start works. See, I can get back to the point eventually. And if you're the kind of writer who starts reading stories or does that kind of rewriting or just trying to come up with your own endings as you go, wandering off the edge of the page with the story, then this is perfect for you. Because it gets you engaged with an idea and then it just kicks you out to go execute it. Now, the publicist for this piece gave me permission to read you one of these exercises, and I think that'll show you what this is about more than I could explain it. So here we go. This is by Hal Zena Bennett. It is from Write Starts, and it's called Get Unreal, a Writing Exercise. Legend has it that Picasso once got into a discussion with a neighbor who looked at his paintings and told the artist that while his colors were very nice and the picture was very pleasant, he should try making them a bit more realistic. Otherwise, he advised nobody would know what Picasso's paintings were supposed to be about. The artist, exercising a rare amount of patience, nodded thoughtfully and asked his neighbor if he had an example of what he meant by realistic. Ah, yes, I do. The neighbor quickly reached into his pocket, brought out his wallet, and handed over a photograph of his wife to Picasso to see. Now that's what I call realistic, he proclaimed. Picasso took the photo in his hand, turned it this way and that, studied it from every angle, then handed it back to its owner. She's awfully small and flat, he said. In writing, as with painting, there's an ongoing dialogue about what's real. Is the author's description of the house realistic? Is the communication between characters true to life? Is the story credible? Could it happen in real life? Is the motivation of a character psychologically plausible? Is this or that action physically plausible? Sooner or later, writers come to the full realization that the reality depicted on the page or on the canvas of the painter has its own reality and is not a copy of life. The ultimate question we need to ask ourselves is, does it work as a story and on its own terms? Consider Franz Kafka's story, The Metamorphosis, about a man who turns into a bug. It couldn't happen in real life, but within the framework of the story, it is convincing. Nor does that author try to convince us that it's possible for humans to turn into bugs. However, he creates a reality on the page that causes us to identify with the poor victim so much that our skin crawls. We suffer Kafka's character with his bewilderment and then with his abject horror at what's happening to him. How does Kafka draw us into this reality? As readers, we must, of course, be willing to go along with what the author creates. It's that willing suspension of disbelief thing all over again. In this particular story, Kafka accomplishes this with the very first sentence. As Gregor Samsa awoke one morning from uneasy dreams, he found himself transformed in his bed into a giant insect. The author never attempts to explain how this happened or to justify its feasibility. Instead, he focuses our attention on what Gregor is experiencing. He describes, well, nothing more or less than what a normal person would experience if he woke up one morning to find he'd become a giant insect. At first, Gregor's reactions are very human. He notes the size and number of his insect legs, and then a framed photo on his wall and the alarm clock that reminds him with horror that he's late for work. Many of his responses are downright mundane, which oddly enough makes us believe the story even more. For example, he looks out the window and sees that the sky is overcast, and it made him quite melancholy. He also struggles to make the horrible reality of his metamorphosis go away, shutting his eyes to keep from seeing his struggling legs. As time goes on, Gregor becomes increasingly bug-like. He discovers that his feet have a kind of stickiness that gives him traction with the floor, that his efforts to speak only produce strange, undecipherable sounds, and that his appearance horrifies his parents and his beloved sister. Through trial and error and her own loving kindness, his sister discovers that in his present manifestation as a bug, he likes rotting food, and notes that he seems repelled by fresher foods. In fact, he drags the decomposing food away from the fresh so he can better savor his consumption of them. The ludicrousness of the story is made believable through the author's ability to describe the very human reactions of his protagonist. While we might not believe it possible for Homo sapiens to turn into bugs, we can imagine the experience of being rendered helpless, imprisoned in our own bodies, and alienated from loved ones. In the end, that's the message we go away with, made possible by creating a reality that could exist only in fiction, but that is nevertheless meaningful and purposeful, reminding us of the limits of our own mortality. Using literary devices such as Kafka does in Metamorphosis, write a few paragraphs or even a short story about what it might be like to wake up one morning to find that you are living in a world, and perhaps a body, very different from your own. Create a reality that could exist only on paper, yet that is credible in whatever terms you set up. That could be anything from being an animal in the wild to being an inanimate object. Maybe it's a reality existent on a different plane, or in a parallel universe, or an imagined world that no one ever heard of. The experiences of characters you create could be horrifying or wonderful, pleasing and filled with discovery and insight, or limiting and dreadful as being turned into a bug. But the bottom line is that this is a reality completely of your own making, and certainly not small and flat like the photo of Picasso's neighbor. And I think that's a really good prompt to end on. So that should wrap us up for this week. Until next time, feed the muse and keep writing.